Greetings. This week we're having Gwen Olson back. Gwen is an activist and author of the best-selling book titled Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher. She's now living outside the United States and hasn't been granting any interviews as of late. But I made contact with her, and she accepted to be on Veritas. Our new interview will air on Thursday, September the 23rd. And Gwen says she has a lot to say. For that reason, I'm airing our original interview today, in case you're not familiar with her. She has an important story, and it is today more than ever that our information has become even more crucial. If you're not subscribed to Sanitas Radio, which is separate from Veritas Radio, and there are three full seasons of interviews that I guarantee will change your life forever, go to sanitasradio.com for more information. That's it for now. Enjoyed this encore presentation, and I'll be back with you tomorrow with a new episode with Gwen Olson. You don't want to miss it. Enjoy.
The information presented on this program is not intended to take the place of your personal physician's advice and is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Discuss this information with your own physician or healthcare provider to determine what is right for you. Welcome to Sanitas at sanitasradio.com, because your health and longevity should not be classified information. And now, here's your host, Mel Fabregas.
Greetings, I'm your host, Mel Fabregas. Welcome to Sanitas, where we declassify the secrets to your health. Shall we? Did you know that adverse reactions to prescription drugs are among the common causes of death in industrialized nations? It has never been the intent of any drug maker to improve health. Instead, their goal has always been to maximize profits at the expense of health. As Einstein said, the world is a dangerous place, not because of those who do evil, but because of those who look on and do nothing. Gwen Olson has chosen to do something, and she's coming up next. Right now, on Sanitas. Gwen Olson is the author of the award-winning book, Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher. Gwen has also published health-related articles in the Wellbeing Journal, Natural News, and the Health News Digest. Gwen is a passionate mental health activist, writer, and dynamic speaker who devotes much of her time to mental health and child advocacy. A 15-year veteran pharmaceutical rep from 1985 to 2000, Gwen worked for McNeil Pharmaceutical, Syntex Laboratories, Bristol Myers Squibb, Abbott Laboratories, and Forest Laboratories. Gwen has a unique industry insider's perspective of the current U.S. healthcare dilemma and utilizes both her experience and the insight she received in her extensive sales training with pharma to illuminate marketing trends and illustrate how current greed and conflicts of interest make the system itself the biggest health risk to American consumers. For the past 7 years, Gwen has made hundreds of appearances and presentations and has been interviewed and featured on national and international television, radio, online and print media, documentary films, etc. And directly from Austin, Texas, I would like to welcome a very brave woman to Sanitas, Gwen Olson. Hello, Gwen, and welcome to Sanitas. How are you?
I'm doing great, Mel. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And Gwen, I got exposed to your work a few weeks ago, and I could not even spend one more minute listening to your videos before I made contact with you, because the people who listen to us need to have this knowledge, especially parents for their children, because it seems that the pharmaceutical industry is now really targeting this sector. But before we start, give us a little bit of a background. I read an extensive bio, but tell us more about yourself, because this is an autobiographical book that you've written. You've gone through so much, and your loved ones too. Tell us more.
Well, actually, as you said, this is pretty much an autobiography, but I really worked in the pharmaceutical industry from the years 1985 until the year 2000. And I had no intention when I left the pharmaceutical industry of speaking out against the industry or you know, becoming a whistleblower, so to speak. Because when you do that, we sign confidentiality agreements as pharmaceutical reps. So when you speak out against the industry and you take an oppositional position, then you forfeit all of your benefits and everything because of that confidentiality agreement. So I had no intention of speaking out, but I was very disgruntled and very unhappy with what I had started observing over a period of time in the industry. It wasn't like I had this awareness one day, you know, like one day I realized, oh my God, this is a horrible industry and I need to get out. It was a series of events that took place over a number of years where I started recognizing that the system itself was a bigger danger to the individuals than were the disease states that they were presenting with. That the drugs that we were giving them as cures were in fact not cures. They were more problematic sometimes than the disease states that the drugs were treating. And I started to see that I was being encouraged on a consistent basis to misinform healthcare providers and to get those physicians to prescribe my products regardless of what their best judgment was. So as I started recognizing that my position was a marketing job and it wasn't an educational position, which is what I had bought into, that I was out there trying to educate physicians to give them good information so that they could make fair, balanced decisions for their patients, I realized my job was a marketing job. My job was to increase the bottom line of my company's drug portfolio. And if I couldn't do that, I was told that on a daily basis that there were 500, you know, 600 men standing in line that wanted my job. So I was constantly encouraged to do things that I felt was a danger to the consumer. And as that continued to go forward, I got very disgruntled with my job. And of course, I had a very severe adverse reaction myself to antidepressants in 1992. And I was in the midst of a divorce, and I had been prescribed a Zoloft, which is an SSRI, which is a selective serotonin reuptake, or norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. And these are the drugs that have, if you follow, you know, the news on these particular products, there's been a lot of controversy about them causing manic psychotic reactions, about them causing suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, diabetes. It just goes on and on and on. There's a number of adverse events that were related to this category of drugs, and I wasn't familiar with that. And I personally had an adverse event that made me become manic psychotic. So, long story short, because I had had a personal experience with antidepressants and seen that there was something going on with this category of drugs that didn't meet the eye, because this was in 1992 when the drugs had just come out, there wasn't that body of information out there on the internet that you can now find just about anywhere that you look on a search engine. So I wasn't familiar as to what had exactly happened to me, but I knew that I'd had an adverse reaction, and I knew that this drug category was problematic. Well, I had a niece who was 18 years old, and she was in college, Indiana University, attending pre-med, and she was in a car accident, and she was prescribed Vicodin, which is hydrocodone. It's a central nervous system depressant painkiller, narcotic painkiller, and she became addicted. And one of the side effects of this particular product is depression. You will become depressed when you're on a central nervous system depressant for any long period of time. That's one of the side effects. And, of course, she also had a lot of sedative properties from the drug. So she had a difficult time staying up late at night and studying for her, you know, final exams. So she went to a health food store and purchased some ephedra, which ephedra is a stimulant. And she wasn't aware that mixing that with her Vicodin could be problematic and cause her an adverse reaction. And long story short, she also had an adverse event on antidepressants combined with the stimulant drug and became manic psychotic. Mm. And when she became manic psychotic, she showed up at the local hospital and they labeled her as being bipolar and started her on another regimen of drugs, antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, antidepressants. It just went on and on and on till she was on a cocktail of about 14 different drugs at one period in time. And none of the drugs were working. And the reason none of the drugs were working was because she was obviously toxic. She was having a toxicity reaction. And what you do when you have a toxicity reaction to a drug is not to add more chemicals into the bloodstream. You should stop the drug and you should detoxify the body until the adverse event goes away. And then you can rechallenge. If you're questioning whether or not it was the drug that was actually causing the problem, you can rechallenge and then you know exactly where the problem lies. But that is not the way that doctors are trained to prescribe and to use psychiatric drugs. So doctors do not withdraw a drug when someone has an adverse event. They simply add more drugs in order to manage the symptoms that are created by the first drug. So what that did for my niece was put her on the road to being a mental patient. And this is the agenda, and this is what I'm trying to alert and alarm people about, is that they put you on one of these drugs and they tell you you're going to be on these drugs for the rest of your life. And basically, if you buy into this agenda, you will be on these drugs for the rest of your life, because you cannot stay on one of these drugs without becoming addicted. And once you get addicted, then when you try to withdraw, you go back to your healthcare provider with these horrendous withdrawal side effects that mimic the exact same symptoms you were given the drugs for, only they're more intense now. So when you go back to the physician and you say, well, you know, now not only am I depressed, but now I'm having panic and I can't sleep at night and I feel like I'm going to have a heart attack, or you start giving them additional, you know, symptoms to add to your symptomatology, then they're going to turn to you and say, well, you know, we thought that you were depressed, but now we realize that you've had this other reaction, that this is actually part of a bipolar disorder spectrum, and therefore, you know, you're going to have to add mood stabilizers, you're going to be on antipsychotics, you're going to be on this drug and that drug for the rest of your life. And that is what happens. You end up a drug addict and you end up on their drugs of choice for the rest of your life. And eventually, these drugs are brain damaging therapeutics. And eventually, they cause you to deteriorate over time. So there is a little tagline for that in the industry. It's called the revolving door of psychiatry. You literally will come back every time you're hospitalized or every time you have a breakthrough or a breakdown on a psychiatric drug. They know that when you come back, you will be back again, because it's a revolving door syndrome. You come back repeatedly, and each time you come back, your level of function has declined. So I stepped in knowing that what was going on with my niece was a drug reaction, had her come down to Texas to try to deal with that and do my research and figure out a way to help her. And while I was in the process of doing that, she has such severe withdrawal when she tried to quit her antidepressants and her antipsychotics and all of the drugs cold turkey on her own. And of course, by the time I got her to Texas and realized that she had gotten off of all of these drugs cold turkey, it was too late to reintroduce drugs. It would have created more risk to her. And she was absolutely in a withdrawal tailspin. So it took quite a bit of time to even stabilize her. And once we got her stabilized, she was still severely depressed and paranoid. She couldn't even go out and make a trip to the grocery store or anywhere normal to do anything normal. And we're talking about a woman, a young woman who had a genius IQ prior to this. I mean, she literally was a genius. And she couldn't even function socially or mentally to do anything. So my sister, under the advice of the doctors and, you know, the mental health care facility and everyone that was involved, came back to forcibly take my niece back to the psychiatrist and make her go back on her drugs. And when my niece heard she was coming home to do that, she walked into one of her younger sister's rooms and took an oil lantern, poured the oil over herself and ignited it, and she burned herself alive. And I just knew that I could never, ever be the same person again, that I had a moral obligation to tell people what I had uncovered, what I had experienced in that industry, what I knew to be a fact, that they were targeting our children as an expansion market, because it is the most lucrative market available to them, and that they would stop at nothing until they had every single American on a drug, healthy or not. And that's what my campaign is about. I'm not anti-drugs. I am anti-misinformation, and I am pro-informed consent. People have the right to know what they're putting into their bodies, and they have the right to know what they're doing to their children. And I believe a lot of parents are very unconscious and unaware of the damage that we are doing to our kids with drugs right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, we can't just say that every drug is bad, but as you say, it's the misinformation that's out there. And going back to the episode that you went through, not to undermine with what happened to Meg, because I want to get back to you know, some of more of Megan's story. But at one point, Zoloft is what you were using. It was so detrimental to your health and to your mind that you were thinking of committing suicide one night, and you drove your car and you were carefully trying to find how to kill yourself in a way that it looked like an accident and not a suicide, because at the time, I believe you had a three-year-old son and you didn't want him to not get the insurance. Tell us more about that, if you don't mind.
Well, I can tell you that I have never been suicidal prior to that event,
right,
and have never been suicidal after that event. So depression was not a part of my normal personality or, you know, my spectrum. I'm actually an anxious person more than I am anything, okay? So being on antidepressants, because they are stimulants, I had a very negative reaction to that. So when I became suicidal, I literally was driving up and down a very windy, dangerous road, 2222 here in the Austin, Texas area, and I was looking for a place to drive off. And I didn't want my family members, I didn't want people to think that I had intentionally checked out. But I was in so much pain psychologically, and I was so, the adverse events that I was having was creating something known as akathisia. What akathisia is, it's an internal trembling that literally it drives people crazy. If they aren't, you know, already feeling crazy, it will make them feel suicidal. It makes you want to check out. At one point in time, I literally curled up in a fetal position and would hold myself because the shaking and the trembling was so severe that I just couldn't stand that feeling unless I was in, you know, a fetal position holding myself. Mm-hmm. So I had gone out to try to find a way to kill myself. But what's interesting about the way these drugs affect the mind was that I was running through this detailed list in my mind of things that were going to happen and things that I had done previously in the day. Had I, you know, locked the doors? Had I let the dog out? Had I done all of these things? That's what I'm going to kill myself, and I'm doing a checklist of things. Have I taken care of my responsibilities?
Yeah.
That's how this drug takes you out of reality. These drugs take you completely into a place of delusion. So what I realized as I was sitting at the stop sign and I had started crying was that I couldn't remember whether I had let the dog out. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I can't, my husband will be really upset, or when he comes home and the dog has gone to the bathroom in the house or whatever. And that thought was literally what saved my life, because it made me, it was kind of like an obsessional, you know, compulsive
kind of
thing.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's like, oh, gee, I have to go let the dog back out, and then I can come back out and try to find a place to kill myself.
Right.
And, of course, by the time I got home and got involved in something else, then, you know, that episode had passed. But I knew personally then that these drugs were what had brought that feeling on. You know, that was not part of my general makeup or my personality to want to check out. I'm a hardcore survivor, as I'm sure you know from reading my book.
Sure. Sure.
You know?
And that's
so,
what makes a difference. I mean, you are a you have your own personal testimony. And then we go back to Megan. You really tried to help her because you went through it, but you weren't able to do so because, or keep your promise, because you said you were going to help her, but the decision makers wouldn't listen to you until it was too late. And that's the problem with becoming oversellers or passionate about a subject. And this happens to me all the time, Gwen, not only with this, but with other topics. You risk isolating the very audience you seek to educate. So how do you circumvent this problem?
Well, and that's the one of the things, the reason I do speak out is because, first of all, I don't in my name. You know, I'm not a doctor. So I have an education that comes from a lot of my own personal due diligence.
And can you repeat the last sentence? Because you got cut off all of a sudden. Just go back about 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I said, what? I'm not a doctor. Okay. So what I try to do, since I don't have an MD behind my name, and most of my education comes from my own personal due diligence and research, as well as my, you know, indoctrination from the industry, and that's what I literally have to remind myself. When people ask me questions, particularly if I'm fatigued, you know, I'm really tired, Sometimes I literally have to stop and ask myself, okay, where did I learn that information? Before I impart that information, because I was given so much disinformation and misinformation myself by the industry that it has literally been a weeding out process of the lies that they taught and trained me on. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
To figure out what the truth really is myself. So the way I address that is now is I try to tell people, if I was the queen of the quick fix, and trust me, I was the queen of the quick fix. I believed that you could pop a pill for anything, you know, because I was very successful in the pharmaceutical industry. I hate to admit this now, but I loved what I did at one time. I thought it was an important job. I thought I was helping people. I thought it was an important thing to be able to educate doctors and to help them because they were very busy and they didn't have time to keep abreast of all of the information and to read all of the journals and to do all of their own due diligence. So I tried to, you know, I subscribed to several high-level journals and I read a lot of information and I tried to be as abreast of everything as I could. But what I started realizing when I started doing my own due diligence, you know, on the internet and things of that nature, and really started learning how to read and understand clinical trials and everything, I learned that they were teaching me erroneous things so that I would go out and teach erroneous things to doctors. So I now tell people that if I made this 180 and I've come full circle and I'm trying to warn people, there must be a reason for that. And I don't expect anybody to take anything that I say for face value. I expect people to do their own due diligence, to be proactive, and to stop taking other people's word that may have an ulterior motive or agenda, trying to make money off of you or your family, and start looking into this stuff yourself. We have the information available now, and we have access to this stuff. People who are going to the doctor's office and handing their power over for themselves and for their children and just taking their prescriptions and running to the pharmacy and filling them are going to be very sick in the very near future if they aren't already.
And here's the problem. See, there's people like you who have an intimate relationship with these drugs because you use them and you actually sold them. But then when you talk to people and they see that you are not an MD and their MD is prescribing the drugs, they say to you, wait a minute, but you're not a doctor. How are you telling me this? And just so that folks know, when I was reading your bio, you worked for five large pharmaceutical companies. And it's not as if you got fired and jumped from job to job. You were considered la creme de la creme, and you perform at the top 3% in each company. Were you vocal to your superiors? And if so, how were you tolerated? Was it because you made them look good?
Yes, absolutely. And I was vocal with my superiors, and you can ask anyone. I was a thorn in people's sides. Because I would question, I'm a critically intelligent person and I ask critically intelligent questions. You know, like, well, why would we do this if it causes more problems? You know, or why would we encourage someone to take that if it's going to cause a side effect?
Right.
And what I started to recognize in the answers that I would get back from management and from, you know, upper echelon personnel was that people were considered a human commodity, basically. And, you know, they were going to lose a few and we expected side effects, but this is part of the cost of doing business. You know, and that attitude just stymied me. I couldn't believe that we were in healthcare and that we actually could have those attitudes about people as though they were a commodity. And I was tolerated because of the fact that I was extremely successful. Just like you said, I could get in to see people. I was personable. Doctors would like to talk to me because I was intelligent and, you know, I'd like to think I was attractive back then. And that's a big part of what, you know, the pharmaceutical industry does is they look for attractive, gregarious, outgoing people that are bubbly and have lots of personality and basically great yes people that will, you know how to deal with doctors' egos and not step on people's toes and be able to get their information across in a very competitive environment because there may be five or six representatives sitting in a doctor's office waiting room at any given time that another rep walks in to try to see a physician. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely competitive. And it's very high level competition. I mean, you're not just talking about competing for your drugs. You compete with everything from what luncheon products that you bring in. I mean, oh, well, you know, the Pfizer rep brings me Olive Garden. You know, I mean, people pitch you against your competition in that manner as well. And then you're also competing against people the way you dress, the cars you drive, the houses you live in. I mean, it's all about ego. It's all about power. It's all about materialism. And that's what the industry is all about, and that's the kind of people that it breeds. And so I'm not saying I wasn't one of those individuals. I was. I was exactly one of them, and I was one of their best. That's why they tolerated me. I made a lot of money for them, and they made a lot of money for me.
And I understand. You know, most people need to make a living, but there should also be a balance, which you found eventually. But in your introduction of the book, you mentioned something so true and so important. So let me read a portion. It says, quote, "We Americans sacrifice our health in order to pursue high-stress jobs and provide for our families. Yet, when we arrive in our retirement years, we're no longer able to enjoy the physical pursuits we experienced in our youth. We must then spend all of our limited resources to maintain or even repair our ailing minds and bodies," unquote. Is this part of the plan, Gwen?
It's absolutely part of the plan. In fact, the CEO of Merck a few years ago stood up in front of his sales audience and told them that, you know, one day we will see every American on drugs and we are going to have them, whether they're sick or whether they're well, every American will be on drugs. And that is the agenda because they don't want us well. I often say in a joking manner to people that if you believe that the pharmaceutical industry is in the business of health and healing, then you probably are delusional and you need to be on one of their drugs.
Yes.
Because that is not what the pharmaceutical industry is in the business of. They are in the business of disease management and symptom maintenance. That's what they do. They don't want people healthy. And the reason I know that is because I watched the number of drugs that would come out on the market repeatedly that were bad news. They knew they were bad news. They knew they would eventually get recalled. But when you can make billions, not just millions, billions of dollars off of a drug in a few years and then turn around and settle out of court a few million dollars here and a few million dollars there.
Drops
for lawsuits.
In the bucket.
It's a drop in the bucket. You're absolutely right. And they consider that a cost of doing business.
Right.
So when a new drug comes out that they know is problematic, that they know has already shown difficulties in the clinical trials, then they will go and they will put aside a kitty when that drug comes out onto the market specifically for litigation that's going to surface later on. It's already put aside.
So they know in advance.
Yeah, they know that it's going to happen, and they're aware, but it's a cost of doing business, and they know that because they have such tight reins and control over the media, and the media pretty much regurgitates anything pharma tells them, and they do very little investigating of their own.
But where's the FDA? Where's the FDA approval and research and development not determining that it's harmful for the in the future?
Well, the biggest part of the problem is, Mel, is what, because I was in the industry from 1985 to 2000, I saw a huge shift that took place in 1992, and that was when the Prescription Drug Users Fee Act was passed, the PDUFA Act, which enabled the pharmaceutical industry to charge well, actually, to pay the FDA. The FDA can charge the pharmaceutical industry for new drug application approvals, okay? Right. And that's up to $350,000 per new drug app. So that's not chump change by any means. And what happened was when that got approved, then all of a sudden, where the industry used to tell reps, you know, that, oh, well, you have to say this verbatim because there's an FDA agent that may be hiding in the office or something and we could get sued or whatever. They used to make reps feel like the FDA was there. They were the bad guys and they were always the pains in our butts. Well, right after 1992 and that act passed, all of a sudden they were referring to the industry. We had friends in the FDA. And I'm like, in fact, I was at a meeting one time where they were talking about lowering the criteria for being on a cholesterol-lowering drug, because I was selling a cholesterol-lowering drug, and they were like, oh, yeah, well, when Lipitor came out on the market, because Lipitor lowered, you know, like up to 47% LDL, everybody that sold the older drugs was flipped out because that meant we had to compete with, you know, a better drug. So right. It made our drugs kind of considered dog drugs, the older drugs that were on the market. So the reps were all freaked out about that, you know? And literally, what they were going to do or what the plan was several of the other statin manufacturers had put a request into the FDA to have the guidelines changed because they had some data that showed that if you lowered LDL below 100, that, you know, that would improve the heart attack risk rate or something like that. So they were going to submit that to the FDA, and our people in the FDA were going to help get these guidelines revised. And I'm like, excuse me, our people? I didn't know we had people in the FDA. And they're laughing, oh, well, you know, not our people, our friends in the FDA. And do you know what happened when they changed those guidelines? Overnight, it made over 36 million people eligible for statin drugs, whereas the day prior to that, only 12 million were eligible. So I asked the manager that told me about that. I said, why are we doing this? If you're telling me that this drug could be problematic that came out because it may lower cholesterol too much, how do we know what too much cholesterol is? How do we know what individual, you know, rates are? And he says, well, we don't. But what we do know is that if you want a bigger piece of the pie, you have to bake a bigger pie. So they weren't going to risk, the other statin manufacturers were not going to risk losing market share to that new drug Lipitor. They were just going to increase the number of people that would be eligible for drug treatment, and therefore everybody could get a piece of the pie.
Balancing the playing field.
That's the way it works, Mel.
Yeah. So balancing the playing field in their own way.
That's right. That's, you know, right. So now you got millions of people that are finally discovering that they have all kinds of muscle problems. You know, remember Baycol was recalled because of the problems that it was causing. Do you remember Baycol at all? It was another statin drug.
Yes, and that's what statin does. It kills your muscle, isn't it?
Right, exactly. And that's the rhabdomyolysis was the reason that that one was recalled, and that's what it is. It's, you know, a deterioration of muscle tissue. Well, people don't stop to think about, what is your heart?
Right.
What are your kidneys?
Yes.
They're muscles. And so if there's, you may think, oh, people that are looking, if you have problems with your muscles and they're listening to these ads on TV, they're not stopping to think about, these drugs can cause kidney failure. These drugs cause congestive heart failure. You may not die of a heart attack, but guess what? You're not going to die of high cholesterol either. It's a risk factor. It's not a disease.
You know, prescription drug use has become the third largest killer of Americans behind heart disease and cancer. More than 180,000 people die annually from the negative effects of legal drugs, prescribed drugs, folks. So this may be unrelated, but I just found out, Gwen, that out of the world's top 100 economies, 51 are companies and not countries. And I bet the pharmaceutical industry is up there. This is a worldwide
cancer.
Oh, you can
guarantee they are. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And they make more money than 75% of the other top 500 companies put together. So, I mean, you're talking about an ungodly amount of money, which gives them an ungodly amount of power. And that's what You know, I like you said, we know that there are some drugs that are good. There are some drugs that are necessary. I don't want to see the pharmaceutical industry, you know, completely done in. I want to see them reined in. I want to see them serve the purpose that they should be serving. I want to see cures to diseases, not treatments for diseases, because what I know to be a fact is if they find the cures, they'll be locked in a safe somewhere until every chemotherapy drug runs off patent, until everything that's in their pipelines is used. They're not going to share that information with us. And if we think they are, then again, we're delusional.
And we talk all the time about this, Gwen, and all alternative sources of energy. And there are two words that really scare the powers that want to be. One is cures, and another one is free energy. Why? Because there's no profit in cures,
right?
Isn't it?
Right. That's absolutely correct. And that's the other thing that we had issues about when I was in the industry. You know, everyone's starting to take vitamins. Everyone's starting to, you know, have herbs. My doctors are asking me, well, you know, what about saw palmetto instead of this horrible alpha blocker that you're telling me to give to my patients for benign prostate hyperplasia, you know, which is BPH. And, you know, I was like, well, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to compete with those things? I don't even have any information about that. And you know what the answer I got was? Don't worry about the natural health industry. If we can't beat them, we'll buy them. And if we can't buy them, we'll put them out of business.
Well, that was,
and by golly, that's exactly what they're intending on doing.
A few months ago, I had Dr. Betty Martini on the show, and we were discussing aspartame, MSG, and she was telling me that...
I met Betty recently.
Great lady. And she was telling me that on the 25th anniversary, to the day of her mom's passing of breast cancer, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And she went to the oncologist and was told, you know, you need chemo and all the process that you go through when you have cancer. She said, no. She started finding alternative cures. And she found this group of people that had this combination of herbs. She used them. In less than a couple of months, she was totally, not remission, she was completely cured of cancer. She went back to the doctor and they could not explain it. Well, the FDA found out. They went after the people who were growing the herbs. They burned the fields and they made the herbs illegal in the United States. Because every time one person gets out of cancer, it's $800,000 that the industry loses. What's your take on that?
That's absolutely correct. And my take on it is that it happens and it's going to happen more and more. Just like when I was talking earlier about the cholesterol-lowering drugs, there was this wonderful red yeast rice product that came out called Cholestin.
Yes.
Cholestin. And all of a sudden, somebody got, you know, a little bit overzealous and decided to go in and detail it to doctors in the clinics, you know. And so they went in and I was going in selling Pravastatin, another cholesterol-lowering drug, and these doctors were starting to tell me, you know, we get this wonderful results with this product called Cholestin. And I'm like, well, what is Cholestin, you know? Well, Cholestin's a natural herb. It's red yeast rice, and, you know, they turned me on to it. And so I told the company about it, not knowing that, you know, the first thing that would happen was they sued the company. The FDA turned on the company that made this. Now, I'm not saying I caused this to happen. I was probably one of a billion reps that probably went out and said something about it, because that's what we're trained to do anytime you hear about something like that, you know? Yeah. And so they took that product off the market because the FDA declared it a drug. And because it was a drug, it had to go through all the rigorous clinical trials and all of that. And my company was quite emphatically happy about the fact that they had managed to remove one of the competitors from the market. And so that was no longer available to people.
It makes absolutely no sense, but this is what happens. But I'm concerned, as you said, if a company becomes competition, they just buy it. I'm concerned, Gwen, that the pharmaceutical industry may be infiltrating the natural supplement manufacturers, buying them, and then all of a sudden mixing some of those supplements with their own synthetic medication, if you will, so that they can be hooked to something else.
Well, you have every reason to be concerned about that. And the reason I'm telling you for a fact, when I left the pharmaceutical industry, I went into the natural foods industry and went to work for a company called Nature's Way. and I'm sure you've probably heard of Nature's Way.
Sure.
Trust the leaf, the green leaf, and used to be a company that the Murdoch family, because actually Mrs. Murdoch had cancer, and that's why the company was formed, because they were trying to find alternative treatments for
cancer. Hold on, Murdoch, as in Rupert Murdoch?
Yes.
Okay.
And Rupert Murdoch? Now, wait a minute. I don't know if his first name was Murdoch. Or Rupert, rather. But it was the Murdoch was the family, and I'd have to go back and look at the name. But anyway, when I was in my final interview with that company, the gentleman that hired me asked me what my biggest concern was about leaving the pharmaceutical industry to come into the natural foods industry, since they were so much in opposition to one another. And I told him my biggest concern was that, you know, my fear was that a pharmaceutical company would buy the company after I got there. And do you know what? 2 months later, what happened? A German pharmaceutical company bought the company. And the dadgum culture of the company went down the tubes. Then we started getting products that were sourced from China that had problems, that had lead in them, that were contaminated, that they were cutting corners. They fired something like 90-some reps that were servicing the country and brought 90-some reps down to 14 different positions. I had an area that used to be just around the Austin, San Antonio, Texas area, and I ended up having 4 states after that I had to cover. That's the way a pharmaceutical company comes in. They destroy, I'm not saying they destroyed their product line. I'm not trying to get sued or anything like that, because I don't believe they destroyed their product line, but they destroyed their culture of the company completely and started sourcing inferior products. So, you know, I'm hoping that situation has been resolved, but I do know that that's the way the pharmaceutical industry works. They'll go in, they'll buy up a vitamin manufacturer, and then say, for example, they won't put the right amount of cofactors in the product so that it's ineffective. So you're taking a vitamin that you're thinking that you're doing something beneficial for your health, but you're actually getting a bogus product that probably the majority of it is going to end up in the toilet stool.
That's right. That's right. And there's studies made that show that in our water supply, there are billions of pounds of vitamins, supplements, and even medication all over. That's just seeping into the water supply. Is that affecting the population?
Oh, certainly it is. I mean, and if you don't think it is, look at your children right now and look at the size of their feet compared to ours. Mm. Look at their height compared to ours. You can tell they're getting exposed to hormones. Look at how quickly young women develop breast tissue now when they didn't. I mean, I see girls that are 10, 11 years old that are fully developed.
Yeah.
And that's just something that was unheard of before. But they're getting all of this exposure, hormones in their foods, hormones in their water, you know, drug exposure. Birth control pills aren't filtered out of our water. So we're consuming female hormones. Men are actually having menopause symptoms now because of their excess exposure to estrogen.
This is just absolutely incredible. But antidepressants, which is one of I would say it's one of the most important aspects of your book, balance my brain chemistry. That's what they do, right? Isn't this what doctors tell you antidepressants do?
Well, there is, you know, that little theory out there that because you have a serotonin imbalance, that's the reason why that you're depressed. But what serotonin is, it's actually a neurotransmitter marker that appears in all kinds of psychiatric illness, not just in depression. And it's very important. It's an important component of sleep and of being not being nervous, of being calm and, you know, settled. And it's also a very important feel-good hormone. So, you know, they found that because drugs like the serotonin reuptake inhibitors would allow serotonin to circulate longer in the system, that because that was the mechanism of action of that drug, they formed this theory that that is what causes depression. Do you get that? So that
Sure.
the drug matches the theory. That's the way it works. Where we really don't know what the cause of any individual episode of depression is, it depends on the individual. That person could have a psychological problem. That person could have a blood sugar imbalance. The person could have gotten exposure to some sort of infectious disease, environmental toxicity. There's all these different things that can cause depression. So you really need to get to the root cause of the problem in order to treat the cause and cure the depression. So if you have a blood sugar imbalance, do you need to address dietary habits, or, you know, or do you have psychological issues? Do you need to find a good friend or a counselor to talk to? Have you had exposure to a deer tick bite and maybe you're experiencing the OCD symptoms that you have because you have an infectious disease? Have you been tested for that? Have you been tested for thyroid problems? You see what I'm saying? There are so many issues. Whereas most people go in, they give their doctor this little litany of, oh, I don't feel good, I'm not sleeping well, I'm depressed, something's happened, and they walk out of the office with a prescription for a drug, and nobody knows what caused it. So they're not going to get cured. They're going to mask the symptoms, and then the issue, if it is a physical health issue, is going to get worse. If it's a mental health issue, it's going to flare up every time that trigger is pushed.
And just a quick parenthesis, I recently watched a documentary called, I believe, What's Under My Skin, about Lyme disease and how it's not prescribed correctly. And so many people are giving the wrong medication that it does not address that. But that's a different show. But Gwen, is it true that even if you stop taking antidepressants right at the beginning, your brain cannot immediately recover its original functions?
That's correct. That's correct. It takes a while before you return to normal function, and it really depends on the length of time that you've been on the drugs and the dosage of drug that you have been on how long that might take. I talk to people on a consistent basis that have been in withdrawal for years, not just months, not just weeks, but years, and are suffering and trying to detoxify their bodies and trying to find help in doing so. And believe me, it's not an easy task. That was the thing that took me aback, that probably I was not prepared for. When I wrote my book and put the information out, I was blindsided by the number of people that reached out to me looking for help, saying, oh my God, help me, I'm desperate, you know. And I thought it would just be maybe a dozen people at first, but I mean, now we're into the hundreds. I mean, literally over the past 5 years, I've had probably 600-700 people contacting me, asking me to help them in some way get off of the drugs and to help them find some normalcy in their lives. And it's been a discovery process for me just to find my own healing, much less to be able to find reliable resources to refer people to, because I'm not a doctor and I don't give medical advice and I don't travel that road, because the pharmaceutical industry would love to shut me down and they'd love to shut me up, and I'm not going to give anybody that opportunity.
I just cannot believe you're so brave, Gwen. But I hate to ask you, do you think this is part of the plan so that people are, if not addicted to a drug, at least permanently dependent on the drug forever?
Absolutely, and I believe this is a way of dumbing down the population and making us apathetic. I get accused of being a conspiracy theorist, and I am not a conspiracy theorist, because I can prove everything that I say. So therefore, that's not a theory. And I know that we are being intentionally addicted to drugs that make us apathetic, that make us quiet, that make us antisocial, because separated, divided, we fall.
Yes.
And that's what they're trying to do, is divide us. And people that are on psychiatric drugs, they don't want to talk about that. I mean, nobody wants, it's a stigma. And even though there are such a large number of people in our population on them, it's still something that we don't want to talk about. Nobody wants to be, you know, labeled. But we're all being labeled, and in that process, it takes away our rights. Because if you get a label that makes you a danger to yourself or others, then they can forcibly medicate you in most states against your will.
You know, and
so you no longer have to even give your permission, Mel. If they decide somebody like you or me that's speaking out and causing a problem and making too many waves, we can get labeled and drugged.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I mention this all the time, but a couple of days after 9/11, I heard former Secretary Donald Rumsfeld be interviewed by a Canadian reporter. And the Canadian reporter asked, so Mr. Rumsfeld, if another attack were to happen, how are you controlling panic? And he said, no problem. It's under control. We have Valium and Prozac in aerosol ready to be deployed when needed. I assume it's via planes, chemtrails, whatever you want to call it, so they can actually do it without our permission. Put it in our water.
They're already doing it without our permission, Mel. The number one product, exactly, in terms of antidepressants for many, many years was Prozac. Prozac's main ingredient is fluoride. They have my water here in the city that I live in fluoridated. They are fluoridating water everywhere. Of course, we've got a lot of activists speaking out against it and a few people that are actually waking up to the reality of the dangers of it. But if you are a historian or you study history, you also know that they used fluoride in the water in the Russian gulags. You also know that they used fluoride in the water in the concentration camps at Hitler. Yes, so I mean, that's part of the reason of dumbing down Americans and they don't teach our children these things, because don't you think that if you had a little bit of intelligence, we might question, well, if Hitler did it and the Russians did it in the gulags, maybe this isn't such a good thing.
That's right. And it's a
Why
waste product.
Why are people asking these questions?
Well, because they don't want to rock the boat, or they don't want to be labeled conspiracy theorists. And basically, they need to wake up, get off their computers, off their blogs, and start doing something about it. Because Gwen Olson and Mel here, we can't do this alone. We need you. And now they're saying they're going to start putting lithium in the water because it reduces suicide and crime.
I'm sorry. They were also going to start passing out statins at McDonald's because, you know, and I mean, think about how ludicrous that is. They're going to pass out cholesterol lowering drugs with your hamburger in your Happy Meal.
Just don't eat the hamburger and you'll be fine, I guess.
Exactly. But eat the box, throw the burger and the bun away, and you'll get more nutrition.
That's right. That's right. You know, I have doctors in my family, and some of them are so happy when the big pharma rep comes along, Gwen, and even those who work at hospitals, they're wine and dine. And I used to work in the financial industry. If I even accepted a small gift from a company, that would have been considered a conflict of interest, and I would have lost my job. A pharmaceutical rep who pampers customers with gifts, parties, and more, isn't this a conflict of interest?
It's definitely a conflict of interest, but it's not perceived that way. And in fact, I want you to know that the vast majority of people, until very recently, didn't even question the integrity of this. Not at all. And they actually, doctors would be some of the worst in terms of trying to, you know, strong arm me to get money from my company for different things, you know, for some tennis tournament or something they were doing, or some meeting that they were having, or some party they were throwing for the office or whatever. They would absolutely ask me for money and not be bashful about it. And like I said, pit me against other sales reps. Well, so-and-so brings us this food, or so-and-so, you know, has a private deli cater our stuff or whatever, you know, because they just weren't grateful for anything. They expected this to be done. In fact, a lot of physicians in my area, particularly here, would not allow reps to even be seen unless they brought lunch or breakfast for their entire staff. So since I was a specialist rep calling on cardiology and some of the other specialties, it would cost me sometimes $200, $300 for a lunch to feed everybody in the office in order to talk to the doctor for maybe 2 minutes. And that was if he didn't cancel on me.
You know, I have something here that I received from somebody. It's kind of long, but I have to read it. This is from a former pharmaceutical rep, and I bet it may sound familiar to you, Gwen. I'm a former specialty neurological rep for the largest pharmaceutical company in the world. I was taught to lead doctors to ask questions about using a drug off-label. I knew it didn't work, and we had flimsy studies to support promoting the drug's use of off-label. But my job was to expand the doctor's use of the drug any way I could. I was good, top performer, and I knew how to work the system. I will tell you one thing, after working in the industry, most drugs are harmful. There are good drugs. At the end of my reign, I learned that the best way to get doctors to write prescriptions for my drug was to simplify dosing. I would simplify dosing and titration so that the doctors would write the drug first, because he didn't have to go consult the physician's desk reference. He knew my drug, so he wrote my drug. He or she wrote my drug and became a keynote speaker for us and got to fly to exotic locales with his or her spouse. My budget was outrageous and wasteful. I was encouraged to spend gross amounts of cash, and I did. I could only spend it on food and entertainment. But boy, I did. I can think of a million ways to cut costs so that the products ultimately cost the consumers much less. That will never happen. And I can guarantee that if the money blown on pens, trips, lunches, dinners, and roundtable discussions went to research and development, we would see cures instead of just treatments. Pharma will never cure modern disease, even if they could. Their intent is to treat symptoms of the disease. That is where the money is. Isn't this a summary of most big pharma reps, Gwen?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's a summary of most reps, to be honest. This is a former rep that has a conscience that has been in the industry for a while. I do believe that the younger and the newer reps that are out there are just as brainwashed and indoctrinated as I was when I was a young rep. Mm-hmm. It takes a while for you to really figure out, because they don't generally hire people with a lot of scientific background. They don't generally hire anyone that has been, you know, a doctor or a nurse or something like that. I mean, those aren't the people they look for, because those individuals have to be retrained.
They know.
Yeah, exactly. They want people that will take the information they're given face value and run with it and regurgitate everything they're told to regurgitate and not ask too many questions. It's like the Army or the Navy or any other armed force. You have a need to know. And if you don't have a need to know, then you just need to keep your mouth shut.
That's right. That's right. And I can't tell you how many times years ago out of college, and even these days, I hear graduates say, I want to be a pharmaceutical rep. Even in this economy, that's where the money is. I understand everyone has to make a living, but if you approach that profession, the only difference between an illegal drug peddler and a legal pharmaceutical sales rep is that those drugs are legal. I wonder how many really know the effects of what they're pushing. Do they know, or are they not told and are simply pushed to meet their quotas? You know, the bottom line is the stock price and the dividends.
They are not told specifically how horrible that the drugs that they're selling are. That's whitewashed for them, you know. Particularly, they're always reminded that, oh, this is a very small percentage of people. And,
right.
You know, when you think about 1%, you know, 2%, that doesn't sound like a lot. But when you're talking about 100 million people, you know, 50 million people, that 1% is a large body of individuals. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
And so I don't think sometimes that the numbers and the statistics have an impact on people. In fact, wasn't it Stalin that said that one death is a tragedy, but a million deaths is a statistic?
Yes.
Well, that's
yes.
What they know. They know that if enough people die, you know, it's like you become emotionally overwhelmed and you shut down and you can't even absorb those statistics. You can't even wrap your brain around it to think about there's been more individuals that have come home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and committed suicide on their drugs or died from overdoses on their psychiatric drugs than have actually died in the wars.
Now,
can you wrap your brain around that?
No, I cannot. And you really don't see this in the mainstream media. I mean, how can we even wrap our brains around this, that more of our soldiers are dying because of these drugs? And, you know, I hate to tell you, but I think a lot of our soldiers out there are guinea pigs. How many times do they get vaccinated for God knows what?
I can guarantee you they are guinea pigs. I have a man, my husband, that went away to the Gulf War, and he was just a weekend warrior, by the way. He'd served his time
National
and was
Guard.
Doing the weekend deal, but because of his specialty and his group, he was reactivated and sent to the Gulf War. And he was a windsurfer. He bicycled. He ran. He was in optimal health. He was an absolute solid rock. And he went over there and they gave him 124 different chemicals that he signed off that he was exposed to in non-toxic quantities. Ha! And all of these experimental vaccines, anthrax, and God knows what else that he took. But he's had nothing but problems since he came back. Critically high blood pressure, thyroid doesn't function, allergies, asthma. I mean, you just name it. His whole body and his whole system has started to just deteriorate because of all the crap that they gave him and that he was exposed to over there. And I saw the papers that he signed off on, but they will not acknowledge that Gulf War syndrome exists. They will not acknowledge the risks of the vaccines that they give to our men and our women over there. And I'm telling you, they are killing them. And one of the things that they do, by the way, I just want people to be aware of this, because I think a lot of people aren't aware of how these agendas go hand in hand for controlling the government and the drugs and everything. But do you know that our soldiers that come home, if they're on an antipsychotic drug, they can't own a firearm?
But yet they can
so
have an AK-47 back then.
Exactly. So they're taking the people, they allow them to be on the drugs while they're over there fighting, but they can't have a firearm once they come home because they're trained militants that know how to handle a weapon, so they can't have one because our government doesn't want them to have one.
This is just incredible. I remember a couple of years ago, and you may remember H1N1, the swine flu fiasco. I followed this. 1976, we had the same situation, but the difference is now that there's immunity for the pharmaceutical industry. If something happens with their vaccines, back in 1976, we had recourse. But my wife took our daughter, our at the time, two-year-old daughter, to the pediatrician, and he said, okay, are you ready for the swine flu vaccine? And of course, I had said no. And he said, well, I understand, you know, this may affect some people, but, you know, truth is, the majority will be protected. The next day, one of the ladies at the office brought her son, a 22-year-old Marine who came back from Iraq, got the swine flu vaccine. Less than 24 hours later, he was vomiting blood, and now he's a paraplegic. He got Guillain-Barré. So Where are the doctors rising up and saying, wait a minute, we need to do more research about this before we can vaccinate people?
Well, there are some doctors that are rising up and doing that, but what happens is if a doctor speaks out, then they're absolutely destroyed in the medical community
they're
among their peers.
Yes.
Exactly, and they're blackballed, and they're very, sometimes their licenses are even taken away. They can't even practice. So they do it at the risk. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm speaking out. I have nothing to lose except for the money that I could make as a pharmaceutical rep, and it infuriates me when people say to me, oh, you just want us to buy a book. Well, yeah, you got my book's a paperback book that costs $14.95. Do people really think I stepped out of the industry to make a couple of bucks a book?
That's right. That is absolutely. I hear you.
I stayed in where I was being bankrolled quite nicely and could never, like that gentleman or lady, I don't know if it was a woman or a man that sent you the email, I could never, any given time, spend all of my expense money now. Never.
You know, folks, and we have to take our one and only intermission. I want you to please take a look at Gwen Olson's work. Her book, Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher. Very important that you read this book. How do people get a copy of your book? Go to your website?
Yes, visit my website, gwenolson.com, and it's GWENOLSEN. I'm in all the online booksellers, or you can get it at Barnes & Noble if you go in and order it, but it's not in any bookstores. But I definitely encourage people to please visit my website and spend some time there and the resources and the videos and things and inform yourself.
I'm always so proud to have a brave woman like Gwen Olson here with me. Folks, don't go anywhere. We have one more segment to come, and we just scratched the surface. We have so much more to discuss. Thank you very much for listening to the first segment of this very important interview. To listen to the rest, go to sanitasradio.com and subscribe. You'll receive your login immediately. We'll take a short intermission, listen to some music, and we'll be right back with our special guest in the member section. Enjoy.
There is an answer. Someday we will know, and you will ask her why she had to go. We live and die. We laugh and we cry. You must take away the pain before you can begin to live again. So let it start, my friend, let it start. Let the tears come rolling from your heart. And when you need a light in the lonely night, carry me like a fire in your heart. Carry me like a fire in your heart. There is a river rolling to the sea. You will be with her for all eternity. But we that remain need you here again. So hold her in your memory and begin to make the shadows disappear. Yes, let it start, my friend.